Attaching the access tube to the main hatch. Can I come up and take a look? Paul asked, unstrapping his seat harness. Sure. We're all finished here, said the co-pilot. Paul floated up into the ladderway aisle. The other passengers were unbuckling their harnesses, bobbing up out of their chairs, opening the overhead luggage bins to haul out their gear. Straps snaked weightlessly as if alive. Travel bags and equipment boxes hung in midair. Looking down at Joanna, still firmly strapped into her seat, he said, I'll be right back. She tried to smile again. The cockpit was cramped with two seats for the astronauts, shoehorned into wall-to-wall instrumentation, but there was a wide transparent port for Paul to look through. The space station was still unfinished. Paul could see a space-suited construction team hauling girders and curved sheets of alloy into place along the station's outermost section, so far distant that they looked like little toy figures. A welding laser flashed briefly. The construction workers all wore maneuvering backpacks, so they would not need tethers to keep them from drifting off into space. The Earth hung off to one side, huge and bright blue with parades of pure white clouds marching across the face of the broad ocean. Paul could see specks of islands and, off at the curving horizon, the wrinkled brown stretch of California's rugged coastline swinging into view. The station was built in three concentric wheels with a docking area at the hub. Once the construction was finished, the station would be spun up so that people in the widest, outermost wheel would feel a normal Earth gravity. The inner wheels would provide 1/3 and 1/6 G, while the docking hub would be effectively in zero gravity all the time. For now, though, the entire huge structure hung motionless against the utterly black sky. It was all in zero G. They're making good progress, Paul said. Had an accident yesterday, the pilot told him. Boom operator got pinned between one of the girders and a new section of flooring they were installing. Was he hurt bad? She, said the co-pilot, ruptured her suit. She was dead before they could get to her. Paul shook his head. How many does that make? 4 this year. 6 altogether. Christ, you'd think they'd be more careful. It's the new guys every time. They start hauling big girders around, and they're weightless, so they forget they still got mass. And momentum. Get hit by one, and it can still cave in your ribs. There hasn't been much publicity about it back on the ground, Paul said. The co-pilot smiled grimly. Rockledge has a damned tight public relations operation. No reporters up here at all. Still, you'd think they'd be screaming about it. Nah, said the pilot. Rockledge insures the workers, pays off the family plenty. Nobody complains. Not yet, the co-pilot countered. The work's getting done on schedule and within budget, from what I hear. Paul asked, even with the insurance costs factored in? The pilot nodded. Rockledge must have factored in a casualty rate when they decided to build this wheel. Yeah, Paul thought, and our rental of space in the station must be helping to pay off their insurance premiums. It's a trade-off, the co-pilot said as if he could read Paul's face. The sooner they get this station finished and operating, the sooner they can rent out all its space. They must have figured that the insurance costs are worth it if they can get the job done fast enough. Pretty damned cold-blooded, Paul muttered. I don't think I'd push an operation that way. The pilot grinned at him. That's why we work for you, boss, instead of Rockledge. Masterson Corporation's Space Operations Division, Paul's former bailiwick, had rented half the innermost wheel of the space station for research laboratories and an experimental zero-G manufacturing facility. Once the station was completed and spun up, that innermost wheel would rotate at 1/6 G, the gravity of the moon's surface. The labs would shift from zero-G to a lunar environment. The manufacturing facility would be removed from the station and hung outside as a free floater, where it could remain in the weightless mode. Part of Masterson's rented space was living quarters for its employees. Spartan at best, they were meant to house people who would spend no more than a few months aboard the station. It's not exactly the Ritz, Paul said to Joanna as he slid back the accordion fold door to their designated quarters. It was a cubicle about the size of a generous telephone booth. No window, but a small computer terminal built into one bulkhead. Otherwise, the walls, floor, and ceiling were covered with Velcro and loops for tethering one's feet. A mesh sleeping bag was stuck to one wall. "At least we're close to the toilet and washroom," Paul said, pointing along the corridor that sloped upward conspicuously in both directions. Hanging onto the door jamb while her feet barely touched the deck, Joanna looked bleary-eyed at her honeymoon suite and said wretchedly, "I think I'm going to be sick." "It's not that bad, is it?"
"No, Paul," she said, her face pasty white.
"I'm really going..." She clutched at her middle. Paul grabbed her by the shoulders and spun her toward the toilet area. Joanna moaned and gagged. Pushing her weightlessly down the short length of the corridor, their feet barely touching the deck, Paul slid Joanna sideways through the open doorway. She bumped gently against the wall inside. "Just let go," he said to her, leaning over her bowed back to start the toilet's air suction flow. "This happens to almost everybody. I should have realized that it hit you. I'm sorry. I just didn't think..." He kept on talking while Joanna puked her guts into the zero-gravity toilet. "It's all my fault," he kept saying. "I'm so damned sorry. I never stopped to think that you'd be sick." As he spoke, and Joanna vomited, Paul fought to hold down the bile rising in his own throat. "Some honeymoon," Paul said to himself. 2 days in orbit, 2 days sick as a dog. Joanna had tried to be brave, tried to fight down the nausea that assailed her, but whenever she moved her head, it overpowered her. "I should have known," Paul berated himself over and over. "She's never been up here before. It gets everybody, one way or another. Damned idiot. You did your thinking with your balls. Honeymoon and zero gravity. Up Chuck City." He spent the entire first day alternating between Joanna, miserably sick in their cubicle, and the research labs and manufacturing facility. The experiments on fabricating thin-film video screens and special alloys in zero gravity and the high vacuum of space were going well. The director of the manufacturing facility was a sandy-haired, bespectacled Australian with degrees in metallurgy and management from the University of Sydney. He patiently took Paul through every step of the zero-gravity smelting and refining system they had built. There were hardly any other people in the area. The facility took up more than a third of the space station's inner wheel, but Paul saw only a handful of technicians and other personnel, all in coveralls of one color or another, all of them busily ignoring them as the facility director conducted the mandatory tour for the new CEO. "The board's very interested in the window wall development," Paul told the director.
"That's good, I suppose,"
Paul went on. "Better than good. If we can manufacture wall-sized screens on a scale big enough for the TV market, it'll make this operation very profitable." The younger man shrugged.
"Thin film manufacturing is no great problem. Give us the raw materials, and we'll make flat screens the size of Ayers Rock if you want."
Paul laughed. 10 feet across should do for now." The director remained quite serious.
"We can do that, but what I really wanted to show you..."
He led Paul to an apparatus that looked something like an oversized clothes dryer. Peering through a thick, tinted observation port, Paul saw an array of fist-sized, molten metal droplets glowing red-hot as they hung weightlessly inside a capacious oven heated by concentrated sunlight. Tentatively, he touched the glass with his fingertips. It was hardly warm.
"The vacuum is a fine insulator," the young man said with just a hint of an Aussie accent. "Just open the far side of the oven to space, and we don't have to worry about heat transfer much at all."
Still, Paul thought it looked damned hot in there. The place smelled hot, like a foundry or a steel mill. Paul realized it was all in his imagination. His brain was linking what he was seeing to memories associated with blast furnaces and smelting forges. Yet, imaginary or not, he felt beads of perspiration trickling down his ribs. The director looked youthfully cool. No perspiration stained his light tan coveralls.
"By focusing the incoming solar energy," he was explaining, "we can generate temperatures close to the blackbody theoretical limit, better than 5,000 kelvins.
Paul already knew that, but he let himself look impressed. "I'm surprised that you keep the droplets so small.
I always pictured a big ball of red-hot metal hanging in the vacuum chamber.